Welcome, everyone, to the 7th Lauren Trottier Public Science Symposium. Tonight's lecture is on alternative medicine under the microscope. 7 years ago, Lauren Trottier and I had lunch together, and Lauren said, what about having a public science debate on what is interesting, what is important in popular science? And I remember saying at the time, that'd be great, but you know, I hate these debates where they've got the real scientists and then they've got these phony baloney people and they argue and I think they're about nothing. And he said, no, just scientists. And I thought, brilliant. I'd like to introduce to you now Mark Weinstein, who is our Vice Principal for Development and Alumni Relations, who would like to make an announcement. Mark.
Thank you very much, Martin. Martin is our Dean of Science here at McGill University. Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Je suis très heureux de prendre part de ce soir à l'une des manifestations phares de McGill, le Symposium public de science Lauren Trottier. Outreach activities like the Trottier Symposia are a vital part of McGill's mission, which involves not just exemplary teaching and innovative research, but serving our communities, whether around the corner or across the globe, in a meaningful and enduring fashion. I can think of no activity that embodies that mission more perfectly than the event we're about to enjoy this evening. And I can think of no person that has promoted these values with more passion, dedication, loyalty, and extraordinary generosity than the man for whom the symposium is named, Lauren Trottier. You need only walk through our campuses or peruse our course calendars to see the incredible contribution that Lauren, through his vision and generosity, has made to McGill and to the faculties of science and engineering. These faculties have advanced in leaps and bounds thanks to his incredible support. From the Lauren Trottier Building, which houses electrical and computer engineering and has become one of the most popular and admired buildings on campus, to the Trottier Chairs in Aerospace Engineering and Astrophysics and Cosmology, to a range of graduate fellowships. Lauren isn't interested in enhancing science within McGill's walls. He is also a passionate advocate for public outreach and the dissemination of popular science throughout our community. Through his generous annual funding over the 7 symposia, the Trottier Symposia have grown and flourished, becoming one of the world's premier public forums for debate and discussion on a wide range of topical issues. Now, the symposia are about to enter a new era. I am absolutely delighted and thrilled to announce tonight that Lauren Trottier has given us a new gift of $5.5 million, part of which will endow the Lauren Trottier Public Science Symposium Series in perpetuity. This gift will also provide a secure endowment for the Office of Science and Society, ensuring that its range of outreach programs, including the mini science series, will continue long into the future. Outre d'être un acte de générosité exceptionnel, une telle dotation est un investissement durable en l'avenir du savoir, de faire savoir et de l'éducation à McGill. Que Lauren Trottier en soit l'architecte visionnaire n'étonnerait personne qui a le privilège de le connaître. I'll finish with a remark Lauren made, which I think speaks volumes about his character, his passions, and his motivation in making a gift like this one. Lauren had said once, one of my favorite destinations as a boy was an access road near Dorval Airport. It was a great thrill to watch as jets came thundering in. It's a thrill I have never outgrown. Lauren, thank you for continuing to share your belief in the wonder and power of science with all of us here at McGill. With this new gift, the sky is truly the limit for us and for the thousands of people enjoying the symposia and the Office of Science and Society will touch over the coming years. Let's give a round of applause for our generous and humble benefactor, Mr. Lauren Trottier. Now I have the privilege and the pleasure of welcoming McGill's Provost, Anthony Massey, to the podium to make a few remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Monsieur Trottier et Madame Roussel, Mesdames et Messieurs, je vous souhaite la bienvenue au 7e Symposium Public en Sciences Lorne Trottier, Alternative Medicine Under the Microscope. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Joe Schwartz and Dean Martin Grant and the organizers of the symposium for inviting me once again to have the honor and the privilege of providing the official welcome on behalf of McGill University and of our principal, Heather Monroe Bloom, and to have the chance to offer some of my own introductory remarks to this wonderful symposium. McGill is a research-intensive, student-centered university, holding itself to the highest international standards of excellence, and it is imbued with an enduring sense of public purpose. As McGill's provost, which is a combination of the chief academic officer after the principal and the chief budget officer, during the course of the academic year, I attend many conferences featuring scholarly discourse in a variety of domains. These events bring research, teaching, and public outreach together in a marvelous way. But the Trottier Symposia stand out among these events as truly important, worthwhile, and provocative. Since its launch in 2006, the Trottier Symposium has established itself as a highlight of the intellectual and cultural life at McGill by bringing to our campus luminaries from the international science community. The series has already provided the Montreal community with opportunities to promote critical thinking about complex scientific issues, from the spark of life to the origin of ethics, to climate change, and to tonight's topic on alternative medicine under the microscope. The Trottier Symposia are special because of the capacity to bring science and academic rigor to the public conscience. Conversations about science reach new audiences and stimulate curiosity. The series is made possible, as Mark Weinstein just indicated, thanks to the generosity of one of McGill's most esteemed graduates, Lorne Trottier. Mr. Trottier earned his bachelor's and master's degrees in engineering, and in 2006 he was awarded an honorary doctorate of science. He is also a governor emeritus of this institution's Board of Governors. I won't relist for you all of the gifts that the Trottier Family Foundation and Mr. Trottier have made, ranging from buildings to chairs to fellowships to public fora and to the Office for Science and Society. Lorne Trottier is a man of great vision, who has challenged McGill and our friends in the community to engage in discussions that bring science and scientific debates to a wider audience. These annual symposia honor his aspiration to, and I quote from the gift, to hold a public forum to inform, inspire debate, and raise public awareness on contemporary issues confronting society today. The focus of this year's symposium, Alternative Medicine, will no doubt do just that by raising the bar on how we in the audience think about this topic. Alternative medicine has been defined as any healing practice that does not fall within the realm of conventional medicine. Diverse in its methods, it is often based on historical or cultural tradition rather than on scientific evidence. But the notion of alternative changes constantly. Treatments do undergo testing and may move into the realm of conventional medical remedies. Whatever one's view on alternative medicine, it is clear that the subject merits attention precisely because so many questions remain to be asked and answered. This is a scientific symposium, so I challenge all of you in the audience to think as you listen. We need to judge complementary, alternative, or integrative medicine according to a fact base. Think about the questions that are raised. Is there any evidence to support them, or are they simply unsupported assertions? Is any observations made to bear on these purported facts? If not, people often just appeal to authority. If there are observations, are these observations reliable? Because if they're just casual observations or one-off anecdotes, they don't constitute a base for scientific judgment. But if we have reliable observations, then we have the basis for forming scientific evidence. So as you listen to tonight's discussion and formulate your own questions, try to think about how to bring evidence to bear on the topic at hand. That is what the scientific method is, and that is why we have a paradigm that is dominant in the form of conventional or Western medicine. Conventional medicine is open to new approaches as long as they are evidence-based and they are tested using the scientific method. So what is the scientific evidence base regarding alternative medicine therapy? Are there or can we design rigorous clinical trials to test the claims of alternative medicine? How do we ascertain the safety and effectiveness of alternative medicine practices? Do alternative medicine therapies work for the conditions for which people use them? If they appear to be effective, how do these alternative medicine therapies actually work? Complementary, alternative, integrative medicine does seem to be on the rise. In health surveys across North America, 2 in 5 adults indicate that they use some form of these therapies. In similar surveys of the medical health practitioners in the conventional system, a larger number of doctors than in the past seem actually to be open to thinking about these complementary and alternative therapies as well. We are in for an interesting evening with no shortages of issues to discuss. I'm really looking forward to hearing from our panelists. I now call on Dr. Joe Schwartz, our moderator for this evening, to open the proceedings. Thank you very much and welcome.
Thanks very much and welcome all. I'd also like to express my appreciation to Lauren for supporting our office to the extent that he has, as well as all the other activities that he supports at McGill. The topic that we've chosen tonight is alternative medicine. And as you just heard, one of the problems is, how do you define it? I used to define it as the stuff that we do not teach in medical school. But I realized that wasn't really the appropriate definition because I do a fourth-year segment in medical school where this is exactly what I discuss. So it isn't true that we don't teach it. I think we need an alternate definition, and that has to be based upon evidence. As you know, integrative medicine is becoming kind of a key word in this area. And it is sometimes loosely used. Sometimes it's just an avenue to introduce some of the less evidence-based modalities into medical schools. Our colleague David Gorski, who blogs on a very, very interesting blog called Science-Based Medicine, calls it quackademics. And this is a problem that is encroaching. What we really have to do is never mind the terms, never mind alternative, never mind integrative. What we need is the evidence. And this is something, of course, that we look for in a scientific environment. This is what we want to teach. Unfortunately, when it comes to some aspects of alternative medicine, it isn't based upon evidence. It is hearsay, wishful thinking, anecdotes, and sometimes just out-and-out flim-flam. Well, hopefully tonight we will clear up some of the confusion about alternative medicine from the scientific perspective. It's not going to be a debate here tonight. What our speakers will do is present the evidence as they see it, because after all, that's what we're all interested in. Is there any evidence? Some of the alternative modalities that you'll hear are very reasonable. And chances are that they may eventually cross the bridge into conventional medicine. Some, unfortunately, are absolutely nonsensical and never will make that transition. However, never will they die away. The arguments will go back and forth till kingdom come. This is the interesting discussion that we're going to get into tonight. We're going to start off with Dr. Harriet Hall. And I'm going to give you a very brief introduction now because in your program, of course, you do have extensive introduction. Dr. Hall is a former U.S. Air Force flight surgeon. And I think we do need to point out that that does not mean that she carried out surgery in flight. This is a particular type of description of someone who looks after Air Force personnel, looks after their flight status. But the reason that we have invited Dr. Hall is because she has forged a path and made a real name for herself as the Skep Doc, writing in numerous publications, including Skeptic Magazine, Skeptical Inquirer, always taking a science-based, skeptical view of alternative medicine. She will be followed by Professor Bob Park, University of Maryland, who is a physicist and produces a weekly newsletter called What's New, which he has been doing for a number of years. In fact, he was one of the original bloggers, although I don't think he likes that particular terminology. What's New is a wonderful newsletter that comes every Friday, although sometimes I look for it on Friday and it isn't there. It comes on Saturday, but you always look forward to it. It's wonderful, and he has written a great book called Voodoo Science. He has appeared numerous times on U.S. network television, constantly interviewed, quoted in the news. And Dr. Park will be followed by Dr. Paul Offit, who is one of the world's leading experts on vaccines. He's a professor of pediatrics, University of Pennsylvania. He's a professor of vaccinology, and he has written numerous books on the subject, including Autism's False Prophets, where he challenges the link between vaccination and autism. And he has taken on Andrew Wakefield, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, who wrote the notorious paper in The Lancet, which basically began the modern anti-vaccine movement. And we're already seeing the consequences of that right here in Quebec right now with the measles outbreak. And you will hear all about the controversy about vaccines and some of the alternatives that are being proposed for vaccination from Dr. Offit. So without any further ado, we are going to get things started, and I'm going to call on Dr. Hall to come on up and give us an introduction. Let me just mention that tomorrow night, Dr. Edzard Ernst will be our guest speaker. It will not be in this room. It will be in the Leacock building at McGill. If you go on the front gates, walk up to the arts building, it's just to the left in the Fieldhouse Auditorium. Dr. Ernst is the first ever professor of complementary medicine in the world at University of Exeter in England, which is where he comes to us from. And he will regale us with all kinds of fascinating stories about what happens on the other side of the pond, including his confrontations with Prince Charles. Let me introduce Dr. Hall.
Good evening. I'm going to be talking about puncturing the acupuncture myth. I get to be a Mythbuster tonight. You've probably all seen the TV show, The Mythbusters, and they like to blow things up. But there are not going to be any explosions in my presentation. Now, you may find that reassuring, or you may find it disappointing. First, here are some of the words we use to talk about different kinds of pincushions. When we stick pins in dolls, we call it voodoo. When we stick pins in babies, we call it child abuse. When we stick pins in prisoners, we call it torture. When we stick pins in patients, we call it alternative medicine. An acupuncturist might call it a jab well done. One of the definitions of alternative medicine is medicine that hasn't been proven to work. And whenever you say that, someone always says, "But what about acupuncture? It's been proven to work. Lots of doctors use it. Insurance pays for it. The United States Air Force is even teaching battlefield acupuncture to its doctors." But that's not really true. It hasn't been satisfactorily proven to work. The evidence is weak, inconsistent, flawed, and unconvincing. And the fact is, all of the evidence out there is compatible with exactly what you'd expect to see if you tested an elaborate placebo system. In fact, almost everything you've ever heard about acupuncture is wrong. You've probably heard that it's an ancient Chinese treatment that involves sticking needles in people. You may have heard that it's still widely used in China, that it works to relieve pain and nausea. You may have heard that it works for other conditions like infertility, that it can be used for surgical anesthesia, that it's harmless, has no side effects whatsoever, and that it's been validated by scientific research. But every one of these statements is false. Even the description of it as an ancient Chinese method is false. Every word of that description is false. It's old, but it's nowhere near as ancient as they would like you to believe. Chinese scholars have gone back and retranslated some of the early documents that their claims are based on, and they found out they weren't talking about acupuncture, they were talking about bloodletting. And a lot of the things that go on in an acupuncturist's office today were developed in the 20th century. Ear acupuncture, that's the acupuncture that's being taught as battlefield acupuncture in the Air Force, was invented by a Frenchman named Nogier in 1957. So it would really be more accurate to call it a modern French method than an ancient Chinese method. And it may not even be Chinese. Historians are thinking now that the ideas behind acupuncture originated in ancient Greece and then traveled to China. And even calling it a method is wrong, because it's not a method, it's many methods. If someone tries to talk to you about acupuncture, you need to ask them right away, what do you mean when you say acupuncture? Do you mean sticking needles in people? Do you mean electroacupuncture, which is applying electricity with or without needles? Do you mean acupressure? Do you mean moxibustion and cupping? Do you mean the system of acupuncture where they implant little gold beads under the skin and leave them there? Do you mean electroacupuncture of Vol, which uses a biofeedback machine? And if you mean needles, do you mean needles in meridians all over the body, or do you mean needles just in the ear? The picture here shows how the idea got started. Dr. Nogier looked at the ear, and he said, that looks like a fetus curled up in the mother's womb. I've got to say he had a much better imagination than I do. But he tried putting needles, like if you had a leg pain, he'd put the needle where he thought the fetus's leg would be, and it worked for him. And there are other whole systems of acupuncture that only use points on the scalp, or only on the foot, only on the hand, or only on the tongue. They can be divided into two main groups, treatments that involve skin penetration and treatments that don't. The ones that don't claim to be stimulating the acupoints through intact skin with every imaginable modality, light, sound, pressure, heat, electricity, electromagnetic frequencies, vacuum, color, hand waving, you name it. Here's one of those, color puncture. You shine colored lights on the acupoints. They explain, it uses colored light, infrared frequencies, ultraviolet frequencies, brainwave frequencies, sound, and crystal treatments as indicated by Kirlian energy emission analysis to gently unlock and release emotional trauma and energetic blocks which often underlie our illnesses, and it assists the flow of spirit information in the body. All I can say is, if that makes sense to you, I think you should seek professional help. And then some people are injecting homeopathic remedies into acupoints. That just compounds the insanity. You're injecting an imaginary medicine into an imaginary point. And we've all learned about the water cycle in school. So if water has a memory, then homeopathy is full of... And here's my favorite, Tong Ren. You take a little figurine with the acupuncture meridians marked on it, and you tap it with a hammer in the appropriate place for whatever ails you. And if you Google for Tong Ren, you'll find a video on the internet that shows a whole room of presumably sane adults standing around holding their little dolls and rhythmically tapping on them with hammers. And when reality gets to be this silly, it's hard to distinguish it from a deliberate hoax, like the butt reflexology hoax that was published in the British Medical Journal last year. A doctor claimed that he had found that the entire anatomy of the human body was represented on the buttocks, and that it worked better to put the needles there. He got invited to speak about his research at an integrative medicine conference. And he had to decline and explain to them that it was a joke. They couldn't tell the difference because some of the stuff they believe in is just this silly. Now, where did the idea of acupuncture originate? Well, in the cartoon, the mammoth is saying, "That's odd, my neck suddenly feels better." And that sounds like a joke, but that's how they say acupuncture got started. They say there was a Chinese warrior who had chronic shoulder pain, and he got wounded in the leg in a battle, and his shoulder pain went away. And they claim that by observing lots of different wounded warriors, they figured out where all the acupoints were that influenced other parts of the body. This never made sense to me, and there's a clue that it's not true. Originally, there were 365 acupoints, and it's no coincidence that that happens to be the same as the number of days in a year, because it was linked to astrology, and it was meant to be symbolic. Now there are over 2,000 acupoints. In Korean acupuncture, there are only 300, but they're all on the hand. Ear acupuncture started with 30 points, and now it's up to 120. And when you add up all the different points in all the different systems, there's probably not a spot left anywhere on the body that isn't an acupoint in someone's system. So you could just put needles everywhere. You got to be kidding. Your back still hurts. How about the meridians? Well, you can take your pick because there are different ancient texts that say there are 9, 11, or 12 meridians. There are more modern texts that say 14 or 20. Somewhere along the line, they came up with what they call extra meridians, 8 of them. And, of course, some of the systems disregard the meridians entirely and just focus on one part of the body. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. How did they determine where those meridians were located? And why can't anatomists find them? Who figured out which acupoints did what? What would it take to verify all those correlations? And think what would happen if you had to start from scratch today and figure out all those things. You'd have to observe a whole lot of wounded people. You'd have to keep records. You'd have to do statistics. You'd have to have control groups. You know darn well the ancient Chinese didn't do any of that. And even if you knew where an acupoint was, how reliably could you locate it? These are maps of human dermatomes that show which spinal nerves go to which parts of the skin. These are very variable from person to person. And the exact same spot that might be supplied by the fifth cervical nerve in one person might be supplied by the sixth cervical nerve in the next person. Look at the veins on the back of your hands. Your two hands don't even match. And if dermatomes and veins are that variable, why would you expect meridians to be consistent? And could you localize them? He's saying, I like to practice before I start acupuncture treatment. And then there's qi. This is the mythical vitalistic force that's supposed to flow through the meridians. You can't measure it or detect it, but it's good stuff, and it gets blocked, and that's what makes you sick, and sticking needles in it relieves the blockage somehow. Now, count the unproven assumptions here. You have to assume that acupuncture meridians exist, that acupuncture points exist, that their location is consistent, that acupuncturists can find them, that qi exists, that disease is caused by a blockage of qi, that needles are somehow affect the flow of qi, and that somehow all of that improves health. Now, I don't know about you, but that's way more than I can swallow. And it's a myth that it's widely used in China. It was once banned in China. It was illegal to do it. It was restored to respectability by Chairman Mao to appease the masses during his barefoot doctor campaign. He didn't use it himself. He didn't think it worked, but it was good enough for the peasants. And today, acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine are used mainly by the elderly and the poor, and anybody who can afford it wants Western scientific medicine. Acupuncture anesthesia is another myth. That got started when James Reston went to China with Nixon in 1971 and had appendicitis. And the story went around that he had an appendectomy under acupuncture anesthesia. And that story is still going around the internet, and it's false. He never said any such thing, but the myth got perpetuated. The reality was he had surgery with conventional anesthetics. And after the surgery, he got acupuncture for postoperative pain, but he got regular pain medication right along with it. You may have seen pictures like this. This is a woman supposedly undergoing open-heart surgery under nothing but acupuncture anesthesia. The first thing I noticed when I looked at this was that the wound doesn't seem to be in the right place. It's out of alignment. It just doesn't look anatomically right. But the bigger problem is she's not on a respirator. Now, when you open the chest cavity, the first thing that happens is that the air rushes in and the atmospheric pressure collapses the lung. You have to breathe for these people or they die. And acupuncture is used in China for surgery today, but the patients also get local anesthetics, sedatives, and narcotics right along with it, and they do a pretty darn good job by themselves. The patients are carefully selected, and there's a lot of psychological factors going on. These people are given strong suggestions that they're not going to feel any pain, like a hypnosis. And they're motivated to please the authority figures, and they may be under threat of exile from their job, home, and family. My colleague, Kimball Atwood, is an anesthesiologist, and he wonders whether acupuncture anesthesia was a form of torture perpetrated by a totalitarian government on its own citizens with the forced complicity of physicians. And what about animals? On the plus side, you've cured my back pain. Well, they say it works on animals, so it can't be placebo, but it can too. The animals... response is interpreted by the owners, and the owners are susceptible to psychological influences. And they probably handle the animals differently after they've been treated. And we know that conditioning works on animals from Pavlov's dogs. And it is true that acupuncture has been shown to release natural painkillers or endorphins in animals' brains. But that doesn't mean it isn't a placebo, because you get the same exact endorphin release when you throw a stick for a dog to fetch. Nevertheless, they have elaborate diagrams for goat puncture, camel puncture, chicken puncture, and even possum puncture. Now, I ask you, how many possums do you think they studied to figure out where all the meridians and acupoints are in a possum? And even if they knew where the points were, how could they find them through all that fur? So maybe all those chi and meridian explanations are nonsense, but that doesn't mean that acupuncture doesn't work anyway. There might be some kind of scientific explanation. And they've looked. They've tried to find anatomical verification for the acupoints and meridians. They've come up with a lot of suggestions, but the studies are inconclusive. They're flawed, and they certainly haven't convinced the anatomists. They've looked at other possible mechanisms, the gait theory of pain, counter-irritant effects, and they've showed release of endorphins on brain imaging studies, but they've also shown release of endorphins when you give a sugar pill to someone. In Japan, they did a study where they compared acupuncture, moxibustion, and a hemostat on the tail as pain blocks in the hemostat one. The medical letter has looked at these proposed scientific rationales. And they've said, well, yeah, there are some studies showing some effects, but it's not clear that you wouldn't get the same effects by needling or electrical stimulation at non-acupoints. Now, Ray Hyman has a categorical directive named after him. Before we try to explain something, we should make sure it actually happened. And before we try to explain how acupuncture works, we need to ask whether it really does work. And it claims to work for all these things, everything from addiction to infertility, from kidney infections to multiple sclerosis. And which of these things have good evidence behind them? Only two of them, pain and postoperative nausea and vomiting. Now, that's not to say you can't find a study somewhere that supports everything on that list, but it isn't enough to just find a study. A doctor named Ioannidis wrote a wonderful paper showing that half of all published studies are wrong and explaining why. There are 6,500 peer-reviewed scientific journals. That means 2 million papers every year, 4 scientific papers every minute of every day. So it's not surprising that you can find a study that would back up almost anything you want to believe. And when you study a treatment that is popular but ineffective, you can expect a lot of false positive results for bias and low probability and lots of other reasons. The best acupuncture research shows that it doesn't matter where you put the needles, and it doesn't matter whether you use needles at all. All that matters is whether the patient believes in acupuncture and whether he believes he got the real thing. Now, it's hard to study acupuncture because people notice when you stick needles in them, so it's hard to find a good placebo control. But they've come up with some sham acupuncture methods, and most of the studies show that sham acupuncture works just as well as real acupuncture. They have an ingenious little retractable needle in a sheath that works like those stage daggers. They've done studies with toothpicks, and just touching the skin with a toothpick seemed to work as well. In at least one study, the sham acupuncture worked better than the real acupuncture. And they came up with this amazing rationalization. They were convinced that acupuncture really worked, so, gee, if sham acupuncture works, that must mean that sham acupuncture is an effective treatment, too. They said maybe light touch and caressing the skin also relieve pain. But they didn't realize that this destroys the whole rationale for doing acupuncture, because instead of doing all that rigmarole with meridians and needles, you could just give the patient a massage. There's a double standard at work here. If a drug works no better than a placebo, do we assume that the drug works and the sugar pill is not really a placebo but is an effective drug? I don't think so. And when you do get positive results on an acupuncture study, they're questionable because the reported benefits could be due to the surrounding ritual, the therapeutic ritual of the doctor-patient encounter. They could be influenced by the beliefs of the patient and the practitioner. And there's all kinds of nonspecific effects of treatment. The attention from a charismatic provider, the long appointment times, the TLC, the relaxation, the hands-on treatment, and human touch. Now, since they've had trouble proving their point with the usual kinds of studies, they've become very fond of doing what they call a pragmatic trial. Now, pragmatic trials were intended to test things that had been proven in studies to work. And proving it in a study might not be the same as using it in the real world. So they take two treatments that work, and they go out into a real-world setting and compare them to see which one works better. And by using pragmatic trials, it allows the alternative medicine people to skip one of the steps. They don't actually have to prove that it works. They can go out and try it against some other treatment. And the cactus study was one of these pragmatic trials. They compared usual care by itself to usual care plus acupuncture, and they concluded that acupuncture worked. But David Cahoon looked at their data, and I don't know how well you can see this on the slide, but these are four graphs taken from their data. The pink is the control group, and the blue is the acupuncture group. Sometimes the blue is on top, sometimes the pink is on top. And overall, there really is very little difference between them. And Cahoon said that this study was designed to be susceptible to almost every form of bias, but it still showed staggeringly small effects. He called it the best evidence I've ever seen that not only are needles ineffective, but placebo effects, if they are there at all, are trivial in size and have no useful benefit to the patient. He said the paper was published with conclusions that appeared to directly contradict what their own data showed. So you have to look at all the published research, and some of the studies show that acupuncture works and some show that it doesn't. So the next step is to do a systematic review. That's to see if you can break the tie or show a trend towards one side or the other. Well, unfortunately, some of the systematic reviews showed that acupuncture worked and others showed that it didn't. So the next step was to do a systematic review of systematic reviews. And Dr. Ernst, who will be speaking tomorrow night, did just that. He and two of his colleagues found 57 systematic reviews of acupuncture for pain. And instead of finding a tiebreaker or a trend, they found a mix of negative, positive, and inconclusive results. There were only four conditions for which more than one systematic review reached the same conclusions. Three of them agreed that it didn't work. The fourth one agreed that it worked for neck pain. And in their article, they explain how inconsistencies, biases, conflicting conclusions, and recent high-quality studies throw doubt on even the most positive reviews. Here's the double standard again. What if we had a systematic review of systematic reviews for a pain pill, and it gave the same kind of mixed results as Ernst's review of these 57 reviews? And what if it appeared to relieve neck pain, but not pain anywhere else in the body? I think I would have some second thoughts about continuing to prescribe that pain pill. And what about side effects? My headache's gone, but now I've got pins and needles. you'll hear the statement that acupuncture is perfectly safe. Nobody's ever been hurt by acupuncture, but that's not true. In Ernst's article, he came up with 95 published cases of really serious adverse effects, including infection, collapsed lungs, and 5 deaths. You may have seen this in the news during the last year. The ex-president of Korea had to have major surgery to remove an acupuncture needle from his lung. And what about contraindications? Well, you wouldn't want to have acupuncture if you had metal allergies or bleeding disorders or had a skin infection. And there's a popular pregnancy book that says if you're pregnant, don't let them put acupuncture needles in your ankle because it'll make you go into premature labor. Now, I don't believe that for a minute, but I do believe there are some patients that shouldn't have acupuncture. And then they say, well, even if it only works as a placebo, why not use it anyway? If placebos make people feel better, isn't that a good thing? There's a lot of problems with using placebos. They're unethical. It amounts to lying to patients, which we don't like to do because it destroys the trust in the doctor-patient relationship. It wastes time and money. Some people delay effective treatment by using placebos. And if you start believing false claims, it leads to rejection of real science. And placebos really don't do very much. The effect tends to be small and tends not to last for very long. And placebos can cause direct harm. And here's a study that showed that. They took patients with asthma, and they gave them 4 different treatments. From left to right, the left column is an albuterol inhaler, which is an effective asthma drug. The next column is a placebo inhaler. The third one is sham acupuncture. And the fourth column is no treatment at all. You'd look at this and, gee, that's really impressive. It looks like the placebos work just as well as the real treatment. But then they looked at what was going on in their lungs. They measured their lung function. And when they looked at that, only the albuterol inhaler had improved lung function. The rest of the placebo treatments hadn't improved it any more than the no treatment group. And this is serious because people die from asthma attacks. And one of the risk factors is difficulty perceiving the severity of an attack. So if someone thinks he feels better and his lungs are getting worse, by the time he decides to go for help, it might be too late. The Center for Inquiry came out with a statement during the last year, and I won't read this whole thing to you, but the point is that recent research has completely unraveled nearly all of acupuncture's claims. And recent research strongly tends toward the hypothesis that acupuncture's positive effects are mainly due to expectation. The medical letter was more concise. They said acupuncture alone has not been shown in any rigorous duplicated studies to benefit any defined medical condition. I say enough is enough. When a treatment has been studied extensively for decades and the evidence continues to be this inconsistent, becomes more and more likely that it's not truly any more effective than a placebo. And they always say more studies are needed, but we have limited research money and we need to use it wisely. The bottom line is there's no credible evidence that acupuncture works for anything other than pain and postoperative nausea and vomiting, and it may not really work for those. And any improvement you see from acupuncture is likely due to nonspecific treatment effects and has nothing to do with acupuncture points or needles. You can't argue with true believers, but I got an amazing email from an acupuncturist. He'd read an article I wrote, and he said, "Your article made me angry. I thought that you had to be wrong. It got me to actually look at the literature instead of just knowing that it exists. In trying to prove you wrong, I proved myself wrong." He looked up one thing in one of his textbooks, and he said, "Wow, that's really interesting. I wonder where the reference is." He found out that there wasn't one, not for that or for anything else in the book. It was just the opinions of the guy who was teaching acupuncture. And he said, "I have gradually let go of the belief that acupuncture has any basis for treating anything." And he has actually given up the practice of acupuncture and is looking for another way to earn a living. He's a very remarkable man. I picked a cartoon that I like for my last slide. This is kind of an amusing concept of a new kind of acupuncture, and it's one that might actually work if it's true that laughter is the best medicine.
Everybody starts off with a slide. That's good. You've got to give everything a name. I don't know why this is, but you have to. And here's a good name, because what we're really talking about is causality. What causes what? That subject came up in 585 B.C., the work of Thales of Miletus. And he stated that every observable effect has a physical cause. I don't know why we don't teach that to our children very early. That does away with a lot of nonsense in this world. Okay. What it does away with is superstition. I mean, superstition is believing in things that do not have a physical cause. That's the meaning of the word. And we're going to run into some of that. Okay. We all remember with great regret that just 1 month ago, Steve Jobs died. It was a great pity. He was a brilliant man. He was not a scientist. He had a great deal to do with technology, but he was not a technologist. And when it came to the problems that he faced, it was unfortunate. This is the same Steve Jobs at two different times, and the changes are unmistakable. They're not very far apart in time. And 1 year later, after this picture was taken, I think, Steve Jobs was dead. But he had sought treatment, not from ordinary, his physicians. He had, look, this was one of the richest men in the world and one of the most powerful. He could afford any medical help. His physicians all urged him, in this particular case, to seek surgery quickly, that there was a good possibility of stopping the disease if he acted promptly. But he was persuaded by well-meaning friends to the first attempt to see if it couldn't be done by some other means. And he began to go through a series of treatments by alternative methods. We heard about acupuncture already, so I brought along a picture. This is from an ancient Chinese text, and it's a picture of somebody with all of the acupuncture points pointed out, and the meridians along which these acupuncture points are supposed to be arranged. And this is all to straighten out your qi, so it works all right. But there's a problem with this. How do they know where the acupuncture points are? How do they know where the meridians are? Well, today, if you were asked a question like that, the first thing you would suggest is maybe they should do an autopsy. Maybe they should actually look at human beings. Let's find out what the acupuncture points are. Well, they're not there. There's absolutely no physiological indication of anything where these meridians and acupuncture points are marked. They couldn't at that time, because the sentence for opening up a human body was death. And in many parts of the world, it's still a crime. But we got over that in most of the world a long time ago. He also went into the herbal remedies, and there are books, huge books, full of herbal remedies. There are lots of them. One of the most popular is called Echinacea. I served for a time on the National Institutes of Health panel on alternative medicine, and we were seeking one alternative cure that would work. We seriously thought that it was important that we find one that worked to show that we were just not against all alternative medicine, which in fact some of us were. So we sought the best one. What would be the best one that we could come up with? Everybody suggested echinacea. Echinacea is a natural American flower that grows wild, but it's now spread all over Europe. And why would that be? You drive down the roads in Europe and you often see echinacea growing, the purple cone flower. It's not a beautiful flower, but it's nice. But why is it in Europe when it was native to the United States? Well, it got spread over there because this drug became, or drug I call it, this so-called cure, became so popular that they began to grow it in farms in Europe. And it had no natural enemies, and it spread, and is now spread all over Europe. So, we're not the only ones that subject ourselves to this. This is much more popular in Europe even than it is in the United States. The other thing that you might have expected in someone suffering from these diseases is treatment with radiation. And of course, the radiation is intended to kill cells. And it's a gross way to have to treat it. The radiation kills those cells that are growing most rapidly, and the hope is then that it will kill the cancer cells preferentially. But it kills other cells as well. But the signs that are put out all look like this one, that this is the code. And they say radiation hazard, unqualified. They should qualify that word every time they use it. We're being radiated right now. I'm being radiated by this light up here. It makes it hard for me to see anything. We're radiated all the time at all frequencies. And they all have a different effect on the body. It's all electromagnetic radiation. The only thing that's different is the frequency of the oscillation in that electromagnetic wave. And so on this chart is the electromagnetic spectrum, and across the top it has the wavelength of the radiation, which is the inverse of the frequency. And so as we go from left to right across that spectrum, we're going from long wavelengths down here, radio waves, up to shorter and shorter and shorter wavelengths, getting up eventually to gamma rays. Now, these are the rays at the top, up toward the gamma rays, that are the ones that kill. The ones down here at the bottom don't interact with the body at all. There is no mechanism by which these waves can interact with the body. That's why you can pick up your radio signal anywhere in your house. You can't hide from it. It passes through almost everything. Only a conductive barrier like a metal shield will stop it. So it passes right through our bodies. At a slightly shorter wavelength, we come to the microwaves. And these two have very little effect, but they do have some effect. We cook our dinner with them. What they do is interact with the vibration of molecules. So they cause the molecules in the body to vibrate. We sense that vibration as heat. When you lay your hand on a hot surface, what you're feeling is the transfer of vibrational energy from that surface to your hand. And you can cook dinner with microwaves. In fact, it's a wonderful convenience. It caught a lot of criticism at the very start, but when people found out how marvelously useful it was, they continued to use it. And as we go then to still shorter wavelengths, we get to the infrared. We can sense infrared. We can't see it,
but we sense it. We feel the infrared. It again is felt in the skin as heat. Finally, we get to this narrow little range of the electromagnetic spectrum that is the light that we see. The light that's blinding me right now is this spectrum down here. It's the colors of the rainbow. We see it going from the red to the blue, right at the top of the blue line. That's where the trouble starts. And we'll talk more about why that's where the trouble starts in just a few minutes. But okay, the visible spectrum is harmless. But right at the very top of what we can see, we begin to get a problem, and that's ultraviolet. And that's why we all have a problem if we spend too much time in the sun. And I can testify to that. So we should, whenever we talk about radiation, we should qualify it. Non-ionizing radiation is that to the left of that dashed line that I have. Ionizing radiation is what goes on to the right. And the first of the ionizing radiation is the ultraviolet. Now, this one doesn't penetrate very deeply. It doesn't cause a great deal of trouble for the most part, for most people, if they don't spend too much time in the sun. But it does kill cells, and it does that right in the surface layer because it doesn't penetrate very deeply at all. So we get skin cancer. So skin cancer starts right at that blue line, right at the top of the blue line. As we go higher, we begin to get other things that go more deeply, cause other kinds of deeper damage. And now let me see if I can. We'll come back to that in a moment. Right up above, down here near the bottom of that spectrum, and let's see if I can go the other direction just once. So we're going to now, we're continuing to move up this this table here, and we're now starting in the ionizing radiation. All right, let me move. Oh, is this much better? For a guy that's practically deaf, I should know better than that. Okay. The problem is when I look at this, I get that. Okay, so that non-ionizing radiation that's coming from up there is causing me some problems. But all of a sudden, we got a new problem. The new problem is microwaves. And everybody has a cell phone. Did I say everybody? Well, almost. We just hit the mark of 7 billion people on this earth just a few days ago. There are now 7 billion of us. According to industry statistics, 5 billion of them have cell phones. I find that hard to believe. If the industry figures are correct, almost everybody on this entire earth has a cell phone. The most remote areas on earth, if you go to them, there will be somebody in that community that's got a cell phone. Often frequent, many people. Even at those low levels of income, that's one of the first things that people want. It is an incredible invention. And Steve Jobs, of course, was deeply involved in that. But in fact, people have been worrying about that for a long time. Could these... We know that it can cook dinner. Does it cook our brains? Well, as a matter of fact, it doesn't. At least at low levels, it doesn't. And when I say low levels, I mean levels that are much, much higher than the levels in a cell phone.
cell phone level is very, very low compared to the other sources of radiation that we experience. But this is non-ionizing radiation. And book after book after book has been written warning people about the terrible things that go on with microwaves. So I listed here just a group of them. There are many others. But some of these did very well and sold many copies, warning people that these microwaves are hazardous. And they have these wonderful names like the Great Power Line Cover-Up, Currents of Death, Cell Phones, The Dark Deception, Dirty Electricity. I like that one. But they get up. The most recent of these that I have listed here was just exactly a year ago right now, coming out in November, was the book Disconnect by Deborah Davis, and which is the last one that you see in this series. The book is selling terrifically. She's done a great job of marketing the book. There's something missing, however, from the contents. So here we are. Okay, here's that last book brought up full scale, and this is Deborah Davis, the author, who describes herself as an epidemiologist and has a PhD, but I looked to see what the PhD was for, and it was for something called science studies. I don't know exactly what science studies are, and I haven't found anybody that can tell me yet. But at any rate, in this book, she spends a good part of the book explaining why this should be a terrible thing to be exposed to. And if you, believe me, if you don't want to put your head in a microwave oven and disable the automatic switch, that would not be a good idea. All this does, though, is create heat. It generates heat by causing molecules to vibrate. The energy of that vibration happens to be the energy of the photons in that part of the spectrum, and so they resonate. But our body deals with heat all the time. I used to run marathons in the middle of the day under a bright sun without a hat. And for me, marathons took 3 hours. So 3 hours under that midday sun, and I did it every day to train. And I pay for a price for it now. But the price, again, is skin cancer. And that's because of the ultraviolet that's coming in. There are no microwaves, but the microwaves which would heat the surface are easily taken care of by the body, which has this elaborate cooling mechanism that measures the temperature of your blood constantly and adjusts the blood flow, it adjusts the heart rate, it increases the size of the capillaries, all of this happening automatically to keep our body temperature at that magical number of 96.8 or whatever your magical number happens to be, and they're all pretty close to that. It's an amazing device, a feedback to control your body's temperature, and it controls the body's temperature by whatever means you choose to heat it. So the body may be trying to warm it. The radiation may be attempting to warm the body, but the body has a mechanism to overcome that, and it's a very effective one. So you have to get a very high level compared to the levels of cell phones, vastly higher, before you would get to a temperature that the body cannot easily handle. In the last page of her book, she has a quote that I thought was very revealing. We don't have an epidemic of brain tumors in countries that have used
cell phones heavily for a decade. But after cigarettes began to be heavily smoked, we didn't have an epidemic of lung cancer. And, of course, that's a very important point. We don't because there's a latency period. Now, what is the latency period? Well, the latency period is the period of time between the time that the cancer starts and we can detect the existence of that cancer. That's because the cells grow by the same mathematics that the population grows. The more there are, the faster it grows. So that exponential growth down at the flat part before it begins to accelerate faster and faster, that's the latency period, up until the point where we can begin to detect it. In other words, if you read that a second time, there is no evidence that cell phone radiation causes cancer. So she published this 250-page book with all of these warnings, and right at the end you discover that there aren't any victims. There are not in this world, there is not a single verified case of anyone who has contracted brain cancer as a result of a cell phone. That doesn't mean they haven't. But there's no way to separate that from the other causes. But no experiments have been done that show at all that this is the result of microwaves. Why is that? Well, interestingly enough, we get to my field now, physics. It's the electromagnetic spectrum. This is the same picture you saw before. And again, we see that the general features of this. And here is all this non-ionizing radiation down here. And way down here, in the midst of the non-ionizing radiation, is microwaves. The frequency of the microwaves are a million times lower. A million times lower than the frequencies of the ultraviolet. That's a big difference. And there's no way out of that. I mean, there's just not enough energy in a micro. I compare this to trying to throw a rock across a river. If you want to hit an object on the other side of the river, you can always throw more rocks, even if you don't throw them very accurately. And if you throw enough rocks, you'll hit something. But if you can't throw that far, it doesn't matter how many rocks you throw. They won't hit anything. And that's what happens here. There is simply not enough energy in photons in the microwave region to break a chemical bond, which is what must happen. And when all of this came out, I was asked by the National Institutes of Health to write an editorial in the National Cancer Institute, in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, explaining what people should know about this concern with cell phones. Actually, the guy who did the work was Albert Einstein. Now, you've all seen the pictures of Albert Einstein. He's got this white hair that sticks out in all directions, and he likes to have his picture taken with his tongue sticking out. He didn't like reporters very much, so he always made faces to the camera. But this is Albert Einstein as a young man. And he's a pretty natty-looking guy. And I always wonder why we never see these pictures of Albert Einstein. And while he was still a very young guy,
1905. That's more than 100 years ago. In 1905, as a young man, he had what was called the miracle year, in which he had five papers published, any one of which could have won a Nobel Prize. And this one in particular, most people, even physicists, did not believe that this was this was such a revolutionary way of looking at things. This was the beginning of the wave-particle duality that we talk about when we talk about quantum mechanics. This is where it all started. So all of the high technology that you see right now that's that coming out at this incredible rate, it all uses this discovery of Albert Einstein in 1905. Because so few people believed it at the time, it was hard to get somebody to do the experiment. But there was one person who did. Millikan. Millikan was the physicist who had first measured the charge of the electron. I had to repeat that experiment as a graduate student, and my admiration for Millikan was unbounded. This was a difficult experiment. Millikan did not believe Einstein was right. This was too revolutionary an idea for Millikan. But he said it ought to be tested. And he spent the next 10 years of his life designing and building the apparatus to test it. It was a terrific experiment. And indeed, of what Millikan found out was that Einstein was exactly right. Now, let me go back just one. Okay. What Einstein said was, at that time, people knew that if you decreased the energy of the photons, that you would get less and less photoemission. Now, photoemission means that the photons that are striking the material eject an electron. Now, why is that important? It's important now. Einstein knew nothing about it then. But now we know that the source of every cancer that we know of is caused by the creation of a mutant strand of DNA. And those mutant strands are formed when an electron is ejected from a DNA molecule. And so as you increase the energy, up until that time when people tried the experiment, it was difficult to do at these low energies. So they did the experiment way up here and thought that when they reduced it to zero, it would pass through zero. But it didn't do that. When they reduced it, it came down, and as Einstein predicted in this picture I've drawn here, when it got right to this critical energy, it stopped. There was no more photoemission. No matter how many photons you sent in at lower energy, there was no photoemission. That's a very quantum mechanical effect. It's the kind of thing that classical scientists just were not prepared for. Here's the article that I wrote for the National Cancer Journal, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and this is just a piece of it. But over there on in the second column, third of the way down, you see all known cancer-inducing agents, including radiation, certain chemicals. Here I am. A few viruses. That's because I can't read it here without eye light shining in my eyes. Okay. At any rate, it simply points out that the energy of photons has to get above the level that it can break a chemical bond. And we know what that level is. And when we get above that, then we can start creating mutant strands of DNA. And that's where all cancer begins, whether it's caused by a virus or by radiation. It's got to have units of energy that large. Most cancers are caused by chemicals of one sort or another, by chemistry. They can also be caused, as I say, by a few biological causes. But for the most part, they are caused by radiation and by chemicals. At any rate, as we go above that, then we get to the point that the criticism we get there is only one way of knowing. I wrote that into a paper, and believe me, I've heard about it. That the only way of knowing anything is by experimentation, scientific experimentation. We're born knowing nothing. We're a blank slate. And it all gets filled in after that. But without experimentation, without experimental science, everything else is just superstition. Thank you.
First, I'd like to thank Lauren Trottier for putting on this symposium and Joe for inviting me. What Joe had asked me to talk about was alternative medicine as it relates to vaccines. So what I thought I'd talk about is something that's become quite a phenomenon in the United States, which is something called Dr. Bob's alternative vaccine schedule. There's a doctor in Southern California, which probably tells you everything you need to know, named Bob Sears, who wrote a book called The Vaccine Book, Making the Right Decision for Your Child. And what Dr. Sears has done is sort of taken advantage of a fear among parents that children are just getting too many vaccines too soon. It's somehow overwhelming or weakening or perturbing their immune systems, and we need to find a better way. And so he basically just sat down in his office and came up with a different schedule, which in part is shown here. And I give him credit, certainly, for the use of the term alternative. It's a good word, right? I mean, reasonable alternative, alternative medicine, or alternative energy, alternative music. It's a delayed vaccine schedule. I mean, what Dr. Bob's advocating for is delaying or separating or spacing out or withholding vaccines. So what I thought I would do is go through sort of the logic of Dr. Bob's schedule. You have to actually admire the hubris of a guy who, first of all, has never published a single paper in the world of vaccines. He's never done any research on vaccines. He's never been on a data safety monitoring board or sat on a biological license application. He just sat in his office and made up a schedule, which tells you how little he appreciates what goes into making the vaccine schedule. When you put a new vaccine onto the schedule, you have to show that vaccine doesn't interfere with the immunogenicity profile or the safety profile of existing vaccines, and vice versa. There are hundreds and hundreds of these studies. They're called concomitant use studies. So the science of vaccinology stands on a mountain of scientific evidence. So the first, I think, concern is that children just get too many vaccines too soon, that they just can't handle it. Probably the biggest flag waver for this is Jenny McCarthy. She's shown there, a second from the left, is as you go from left to right, it's Larry King, Jenny McCarthy, a Defeat Autism Now doctor named Jerry Cartsonil and Holly Robinson-Pete. Both Jenny McCarthy and Holly Robinson-Pete are mothers of children with autism. I don't know how it works here, but we all look to Jenny McCarthy for healthcare advice in the United States. She's sort of our go-to person. Because I think if you want science advice, you want it from people who are pretty. I don't see why. Scientists are generally not that good looking, so that's not who you want to get it from. But so they discussed this issue of, you know, sort of what causes vaccines. It wasn't exactly like a night at the Algonquin roundtable, but at one point, Jenny McCarthy sort of held up a sign that sort of showed all the vaccines that children got, the presumption being that it was just too many. So let's talk about this. The 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, we had one vaccine, which was the smallpox vaccine. So that meant that children could, by 2 years of age, get one vaccine and one shot at one time. In 1980, we had we no longer had the smallpox vaccine, which we stopped using in the United States in the early 1970s. We had the diphtheria, tetanus, and the so-called whole cell pertussis vaccine. This was an older version of the pertussis or whooping cough vaccine. We had Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine and the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which would meant that children could get as many as 5 shots by 2 years of age and 2 shots at one time. Now, in 2011, the schedule certainly is far more complex, which includes all the vaccines that you see here, which means that children can get as many as 26 inoculations in the first few years of life and 5 shots at one time. And I don't care how sophisticated you are in the areas of virology or immunology or bacteriology, when you watch your child getting laid down on that crinkly white paper and get 5 shots at one time, it just feels wrong. It feels like it's more than they could ever handle. So the question is it? Of interest, we actually have fewer immunological components in vaccines today than we had 100 years ago, because it's not really the number of shots that matters, although we would all agree that 14 vaccines is greater than one vaccine. It's the number of challenges in the vaccine that matter. And by immunological component, what I mean in the case of viruses or viral proteins, or in the case of bacteria, bacterial proteins, or bacterial polysaccharides, which is just that complex sugar coating that surrounds the bacteria. Each of those I'm counting as an immunological component. So if you look at the smallpox vaccine of 100 years ago, smallpox is the largest of the mammalian viruses. It's actually the only virus that you can see in the cytoplasm of cells under light microscopy. It contains about 200 structural and non-structural proteins. In 1980, if you look at this list, the sort of the elephant in the room was the whole cell bacterial vaccine. That was the only whole bacterial vaccine that we gave routinely in the United States. It was made by taking pertussis bacteria, growing it up in media, killing it with an aldehyde like formaldehyde, and that was that vaccine. It was a whole bacterium, and so it had all the structural and non-structural proteins as well as polysaccharides of pertussis. So you could get as many as 3,000 antigens. Now, since that time, we have a much more purified version of that vaccine. So if you actually add up all the number of immunological components in vaccines, it's between 150 to 153. It's actually fewer than was that one vaccine that we got, the smallpox vaccine in 1900. So although we get more vaccines today, the challenge from vaccines is actually less because we've had advances in things like protein chemistry, protein purification, recombinant DNA technology that's made for purer, safer vaccines. Also, the notion that vaccines would be overwhelming the immune system is pretty fanciful. You know, when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal and then the world, you're not. And very quickly you have living on the surface of your body trillions of bacteria. I mean, literally trillions of bacteria. You have about 10 to the 14th bacteria on the surface of your body. That's 100 trillion bacteria. That's actually more than you have cells in your body, which is about 10 to the 13th. So you have 10 times more bacteria on your body than you have cells in your body. You could argue that you know that if a spaceman came from outer space and saw you, they would just see you as a mechanism of transporting bacteria from one place to the next. And we make an immune response to those bacteria. You make a vigorous so-called secretory immunoglobulin A response, which is the kind of antibody you make at mucosal surfaces like the nose and the intestine and the surface of the lungs. To meet that challenge, a typical adult human will make 5 grams of secretory immunoglobulin A a day. That's a tremendous metabolic commitment by the host to a single type of protein because you want to make sure that those bacteria that are on your surfaces stay on your surfaces. And, in fact, children can make excellent immune responses even at birth. We give the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. The BCG vaccine is not given routinely in the United States, but it is given in many countries at birth and induce excellent immune responses. And the reason that we give vaccines early is because we need to, because diseases like Haemophilus influenza B or pneumococcus or Haemophilus influenza B, which can cause HIB and pneumococcus, can cause sepsis and meningitis and pneumonia, that peak of incidence first starts to occur around 6 months of age. So you need to be immune by then. That's why you immunize early. Another concern that's raised by Bob Sears, and this is his biggest, and this is why he chooses to sort of never give more than 2 vaccines at one time, is the fear of aluminum overload. And this is easy. You know, if you want to really appeal to people's fears, just use a chemical name. Probably the best example of this is is Penn and Teller, who you probably know them. They're comedians. They have this thing on YouTube, which you should take a look at. But what they do is they're collecting petitions to ban dihydroxyminoxide from the face of the earth. So Penn is the sort of bigger, funnier guy, and then you have Teller's the little guy that never talks. But so they have a blackboard out, dihydroxy, two hydrogen atoms, monoxide, one oxygen. It's water. So, and what's great about this is they send a friend of theirs to a fair in California where she's now to collect these signatures. And what's great about this, and you can see it on YouTube, it's about 3 minutes long. She never lies. She says, it's dihydroxyminoxide. It's in our rivers. It's in our streams. As a consequence, it's in our urine. It's in our tears. And she gets about 300 people to ban water from the face of the earth because she uses a chemical name. So just the mention of this. Same thing with mercury. That mercury, ethyl mercury, is a preservative that's used in the flu vaccine. In multi-dose vials, and just the notion of just mention that sort of mercury at high levels can be neurotoxic, but not at the trace levels that we all encounter every day. But again, you're not going to see the National Center for the Appreciation of Heavy Metals standing up in defense of mercury. So this is an easy appeal, and I think that's how that works. So in the vaccine book, he says the alternative schedule suggests only one aluminum-containing vaccine at a time in infant years. By spreading out the shots, you spread out the exposure so infants can process the aluminum without it reaching toxic levels. Now, aluminum is I'm out of my league, actually. When I have Joe Schwartz sitting up here, and I'm going to talk about chemistry, but I should stick to biology. But aluminum is the third most abundant element on the Earth's surface and the most abundant metal. As a consequence, aluminum is in the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the water that we drink. The greatest source of aluminum is in food. Adults will typically ingest about 5 to 10 milligrams of aluminum every day, and aluminum is found naturally in teas, herbs, and spices. Now, it's also added to foods such as leavening agents, anti-caking agents, emulsifiers, and coloring agents, and found commonly in pancake mixes, self-rising flours, baking powder, processed cheese, and cornbread. So it's also found in breast milk. Anybody who lives on the surface of this earth will encounter aluminum everywhere, and so it's going to be in breast milk. It's going to be in infant formulas. And if you look by 6 months of age, if you get all vaccines that contain aluminum salts as an adjuvant, meaning something that enhances the immune response, you'll be exposed to 4 milligrams, breast milk 10 milligrams, infant formula 30 milligrams, and soy formula 120 milligrams. Sometimes I actually have to testify in congressional hearings where the congressman will say, this is in relation to sort of mercury and vaccines, I have zero tolerance for mercury. It was perfect. So if you have zero tolerance for mercury, got to move to another planet, because on this planet there's mercury. So now there are differences, obviously. 100% of the aluminum that is given in vaccination by definition is absorbed, but only 1% of aluminum that you ingest is absorbed. So there are differences. So let's talk about that. Aluminum that is either injected or ingested, when it enters the circulation, binds to transferrin and is eliminated by kidneys, so that about half of aluminum is eliminated in a day, about 85% in a couple weeks, and 96% in 3 years. But you can see that, it's not all of it eliminated quickly, so it does accumulate, so that by the end of the first year of life, if you're exclusively breastfed, you'll have about 0.1 milligram, infant formula about 0.1 milligram, vaccines would add another 0.1 milligram to that deposition, and an adult, typically, people sitting in this audience, have between 50 to 100 milligrams of aluminum in your body, primarily concentrated in your bones. You okay? So now aluminum, like many things, it certainly at high levels can be dangerous. It can cause encephalopathy, which just means sort of brain damage. Osteomalacia is sort of a thinning of the bones, and anemia in two groups. And if you look in the medical literature, you see this as a problem only in when someone is severely premature and on in patients that have chronic dialysis. But really, two criteria have to be met, which is either decreased or absent renal function, meaning your kidneys don't work, and a large source of exogenous aluminum, such as intravenous solutions or antacids. A typical antacid will have as much as 350 milligrams of aluminum in a single tablet. If you look at people who do have aluminum toxicity, typically they have between 100 to 1,000 nanograms of aluminum per milliliter. Now, if you give children with, if you look at children, the blood level of aluminum in children who get aluminum-containing vaccines, they'll have between 1 to 5 nanograms of aluminum in blood, at the time of birth, because their mothers also have aluminum in their blood, and injected vaccines do not raise that level. Sorry, that got cut off at the bottom there. This is just a list of references. So I would argue that that Dr. Bob's choice to never give two vaccines at once because to avoid the threat of aluminum is an ill-founded threat. The other thing that he argues is that you don't want to give too many shots at once. And you could reasonably make this argument that a child is more likely to be stressed if they get say, five shots or four shots at once than if they just get one. So why not space them out? Why not do what Dr. Bob says? Bring children in instead of at 2, 4, and 6 months and then 12 months of age. Bring them in at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 months of age, which is what he offers. This is Dr. Bob's schedule. Now, you can actually study this because, as Dr. Park said so well on his last slide, these are knowable things. This isn't out of the realm of science. You can answer this question. And the way that physiologists measure stress is to look at the secretion of cortisol as a marker for stress. And there was a study done that was reported a number of years ago looking at children who received one shot as compared to two shots, and there was no difference in cortisol secretion, the point being you're maximally stressed at one shot. So you would argue then that if you do what Dr. Bob asked you to do, which is to come in much more frequently, all you're doing actually is increasing stress, increasing needle phobia, again, without benefit. So what's the harm of this? And this is actually my last slide. I think the worst aspect of this is that it's not science-based. I mean, every point of contention that he makes for why it is that one should delay vaccines isn't based on science. And that is important that when you cater to parents' fears that are ill-founded, it's a slippery slope. Then you can argue that you could also, give antibiotics because a parent is afraid the child might have a bacterial infection when they don't. You have to stick to the science. It's all we have. The other thing is that there's clearly harm here. Because now a larger percentage of the population in the United States is choosing not to give any vaccines, it's about a little over 2%, and a very large population, it's just really close to 20%, are choosing to delay or withhold or separate vaccines, you're starting to see outbreaks. So we have an outbreak of measles in our country that's actually bigger than anything we've had since 1996, although it is dwarfed by your current outbreak. I just want you to know you have actually hundreds of more cases of measles than we have, and we're a population of 300 million. You're a population of, I guess, about 7 million or so. So it's a problem here, too. We've also had, is that right? Is 7 million about right? 35. Is that it? 35 million? I was thinking of Quebec. 7 million. Thank you. Okay. So I was close. Right. I should just stick to the United States. And we've had, we've had a whooping cough outbreak in California in last year that was, involved 10,000 people, 10 babies died. That was actually the biggest epidemic we've had of whooping cough in that state since 1947, which is around the time the pertussis vaccine was invented. We've had outbreaks of Haemophilus influenza B, type B meningitis, including three children who died in the Philadelphia area, died because their parents were more frightened of vaccines than the disease it prevented. And we've had mumps epidemics in New York and New Jersey that involved about 1,500 people recently, leaving several children deaf. So the choice not to get a vaccine is not a risk-free choice. It's just to take a different choice to make a different and I would argue much more serious risk. The Dr. Bob's alternative schedule should more reasonably be called, as I said earlier, a delayed vaccine schedule, and again, without benefit. And the other thing I think that pediatricians face, and they're in a tough spot, I think they, on the one hand, want to do the best they can to get vaccines into children if they sort of discharge the patient from their practice because the patient or the parent of the patient is refusing to get vaccinated or wants to delay vaccines. You lose really any chance to advocate for that child's health. On the other hand, my wife's a private practicing pediatrician, so she deals with this all the time. Her attitude is, let me love your child. You know, don't ask me to practice substandard care. Don't ask me to delay vaccines and send children out into a world that has, in the United States and also certainly in Quebec, an increased incidence of measles, in our case, an increased incidence of HIV. I can't do it. I can't be put in that position, so I can't see your child. And so actually, about 60% of pediatricians in the suburban Philadelphia area are choosing to actually discharge patients from their practice who choose not to vaccinate according to the CDC AAP schedule. And another reason for that is a responsibility to the waiting room, that, there are certainly children who are on steroids, who aren't going to be adequately vaccinated because of that, or on immunosuppressive therapy for their rheumatologic diseases, or they're too young to be vaccinated, or they're on chemotherapy for their cancer. They depend on those around them to be vaccinated. In the U.S., again, a population of 300 million, there's about 500,000 people who can't be vaccinated. They depend on the herd. They depend on those around them to be vaccinated to be protected, because otherwise they're the ones who are most likely to suffer and be hospitalized and die. And as herd immunity starts to wane, and I think that's starting to happen certainly in our country, and yours to some extent, then those children are most likely to suffer. And so my wife, because she feels she has a responsibility to the waiting room, is making that choice. Many people think that she makes that choice because she's married to me, but those people could have never been married. I have no influence over my wife or children. So I'll stop there, and thanks for your attention.
Well, I suspect there might be one or two questions to ask. And if you do have a question, we have microphones if you want to approach there. But just to summarize sort of the theme of what was discussed here tonight, I think all three of our speakers use numbers. And that really is the essence of science. We measure things, we evaluate things, we compare in terms of numbers. And that's where we really differ from the hearsay and the emotional interpretations. But we also must use numbers properly, because those too can be misinterpreted. So just give you one little thought here about the three guys who were out shooting ducks. And one says, look, there's a duck flying by. And first guy shoots at it, misses a foot underneath the duck. The next one shoots, misses a foot above the duck. The third one says, gee, great, we got it. He was a mathematician, looked at averages. So you can interpret numbers in different ways. Okay, please, let's keep the questions concise.
Doctor on vaccine, why is it that most healthcare workers, or an awful lot of them, especially RNs, in Montreal, my wife was treated in four large hospitals in Montreal because she had cancer over a period of 12 years. And every time we talk to nurses about that, and I like nurses, they're usually bright people, they would not get the flu vaccine. Unreal. And you had the same problem in New York. In fact, in New York, if you remember the last one, you had the last big outbreak down there, whatever that was called, HIN or whatever, you were going to not pay nurses that didn't get the shot. It got so bad in New York City. Why is that healthcare workers just don't want that flu shot? What do they know that we don't know?
Well, yeah, so I'll give you the experience at our hospital. I would say in 2002-2003, the immunization influenza among healthcare workers, which includes nurses, doctors, nurse practitioners, frankly, anybody who could walk on the floor, it was about 10,000 people who could walk on the floor, environmental services, dietary, was about 35%. That was about the national average. So we really went on a pretty tough educational campaign. You know, it was on the internet, we had town hall meetings, and we got, say it again.
You threaten pays and things like that in New York City.
Well, yeah, let me build here. Okay. So we eventually got up to about 65-70%. Then we had sort of a declination form where you had to, basically what the declination form said is, I know that the patients with influenza can come into this hospital. I know that I can transmit influenza from one patient to the next. I know there are patients in this hospital who are either too young to be vaccinated or maybe receiving cancer chemotherapy who, when they are exposed to flu, could suffer and die from that disease. And I know I can transmit it to them, and I'm choosing not to get the vaccine. And about 20% of people signed that form. Most of whom, I would say virtually all of whom, were nurses, actually. We asked them on the back to list why they were making that choice, and it was the usual bad reasons. You know, I get the flu vaccine and I still get the flu. I get the flu vaccine, my whole family gets the flu. I never get the flu. Whatever the reason was, certainly wasn't science-based. And so we had it. And in 2009, we mandated a flu vaccine, which is to say that if you didn't get the flu vaccine in 2009 at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, you had 2 weeks of unpaid leave to think about it. If you still didn't get it, you were fired. And so we fired 9 people in 2009 who didn't get vaccinated. Now that, we usually never get applause for that, but and of the 9, five of them were union employees. They argued that we had violated their collective bargaining agreement, and so that went to arbitration in the city of Philadelphia, which we actually won because we take care of a vulnerable population of hospitalized children. Because since 2002, there are 2 little girls who came into our hospital, both about 5 years of age, both of whom had cancer, both of whom didn't come into the hospital with influenza, both of whom caught influenza in the hospital, and both of whom died because they caught it from us. And the question is, who is responsible for them? We don't think it's your inalienable right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection as a healthcare worker, and so we took a stand. And I think a number of hospitals now are sort of following our lead, but it was tough. I mean, it was tough to get the lawyers to agree, tough to get the administrators to agree. I don't have a good answer to your question as to why healthcare workers make
that. I wish they do the same thing here, because my wife was getting chemotherapy at the time at all McGill hospitals, the 3 of them that are right here, and the nurses were just not get the flu shot, and she was getting chemo at different times during the 12 years before she passed. And I never understood it. Anyway, thank you. But something that you did like that, I think should be done here. If they don't get it, they're penalized somehow. They're not even asked about it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go over to this side.
Although the information given to us is obviously important, it seems to me that perhaps a core problem has not been addressed. Namely, why so many people seek alternative medicine. Now, surely ignorance and desperation are not the only reasons. One of the reasons is the way the healthcare system is organized so that many doctors don't have the time it takes to properly deal with their patients' complaints and information. And it seems to me until that problem is addressed, then programs like the one that we have right now are going to be of limited value because people are going to continue seeking all these crazy alternatives because they are not being paid sufficient attention.
Dr. Hall, maybe you want to address that one?
I certainly agree. I think we have something to learn from alternative medicine practitioners because they're very good at what used to be called a bedside manner. They're good at the art of medicine. We're good at the science of medicine, and we need to combine the two. And if we can take more time with patients, explain things better to them, and learn how to add placebo effects to medicines that have real effects, that's really the answer.
Thank you.
Let me just throw in one question here on behalf of the few of us in this room who have reached the age of 60. The shingles vaccine, should we get it?
Yeah, if you don't want to get shingles, yes. I mean, probably anybody who's 60 was naturally infected with chickenpox virus as a child. That's very likely. That virus lives silently in your nervous system. And as you get older, it has the chance of reawakening and causing a severe pain, one of the worst pains in medicine, a pain that is occasionally associated with suicide. So the vaccine is pretty good. I mean, it's about 75 to 80% effective at preventing shingles. It's given at 60 years or above. So, yes, definitely. I got it. I'm 60. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I'm 60.
Okay. Can we have the next question?
Thank you all assembled here. I'm Keith. Thank you, Dr. Hall. I love your sense of humor. I've read your work before. Dr. Offit, thank you. I've got my DTaP. We're all fair there. Dr. Park, I have a question. You put the ionizing radiation line at the top end of the ultraviolet. Is there actually a physical line, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8?
There is a reason for that limit, and the reason has to do with evolution. And evolution put it there for that precise reason, to protect
the eyes from the damage due to the ionizing radiation. So it's there to protect our eyes, but it we're still vulnerable to the cancer elsewhere.
Thank you, sir.
If you bear with me, I have both a comment and followed by a question. I had a friend who had terrible headaches. I mean, he couldn't function, saw all the traditional scientific doctors and medications. Nothing helped until he went for acupuncture. And suddenly, he was felt totally cured. It only lasted 3 weeks. He had to repeat it every 3 weeks. But for him, you would never convince him that that is sort of a charlatan effect. It helped him. So there are some cases where, perhaps inexplicably, it helps. Now, the question. None of the speakers mentioned chiropractic, probably the most common amongst all the alternative medicines. Some people praise it. Other doctors say it's complete charlatan and should be avoided at all costs. Could anybody care to comment on that field, please?
Let me mention that that will be one of the major topics tomorrow night that Dr. Ernst will address on chiropractic. Any of the panel here want to give a brief comment on that, Harriet?
Well, if a chiropractor is using spinal manipulation therapy for low back pain, for evidence-based reasons, for short-term treatment of musculoskeletal problems, that's based on science. But chiropractic is a pre-scientific system based on a myth of a what they call a subluxation that can't be seen on X-ray and can't be detected. And if they tell you they're manipulating your back to treat subluxations, that's quackery.
Thank you.
I'll just try and make this relatively quick, mostly directed towards Dr. Offit and sort of by default Dr. Hall, since you write on science-based medicine. I know, I think it was Dr. Gorski, recently wrote a post. I assume you all know what pox parties are, this idea that you intentionally expose children to chicken pox and thus acquire sort of natural immunity. And apparently there's been a recent trend in people actually posting infected objects as a sort of pox party across distances, which obviously would seem to violate like rather a large number of laws. But how hard do you think people should be prosecuted? I mean, clearly, and I think this comes down to a lot of what you see, Dr. Offit, with vaccines, is that people don't seem to understand that diseases are dangerous. And I mean, this sort of seems to show that people don't think about what might happen if a postal worker gets it or anything like that. It's just like, how do you think that, like, A, what do you think this is symptomatic of, and B, how do you think it should be addressed?
Right, thank you. So yeah, and it's made sort of major news in the last couple of days in the United States, the notion of taking lollipops from children who are infected with chickenpox and then sending them through the mail so others can be infected. You know, in the days before the chickenpox vaccine, was first introduced in 1995. If you get chickenpox as a child, for the most part, most people survive. About 10,000 children were hospitalized in the United States every year. About 70 to 80 children died every year. But it wasn't measles. I mean, measles was 100,000 hospitalizations, a few thousand deaths. So many people sort of have this vision of chickenpox as a benign right of childhood, but certainly healthy children can die from it. Well, now we have a vaccine, so you don't have to make that choice. Because the thinking was, okay, let's get chickenpox as a child because you're 10 times more likely to die of pneumonia or encephalitis as an adult, so let me get it as a child. But you could make the argument that before the vaccine there was some value in that. You can't make that argument anymore. So to get to your other question, It is certainly criminal. It is criminal in the United States to knowingly send an infection through the mail, an infection like chickenpox, which can cause suffering and hospitalization and death. So I think that's currently where people are at now, is trying to find these people and prosecute them. That was just in the paper today, actually, in Philly. But you're right. I mean, I think it shows you how much we don't appreciate this. I mean, when Jenny McCarthy gets on Oprah or Larry King and says, you know, as she so eloquently puts it, you know, I'll take the frickin' measles every time. I mean, what that tells you is she has no idea what this infection was. You know, measles makes you sick. You know, it causes a lot of children to suffer and die. And so it's not only that we've eliminated the disease, I think we've eliminated the memory of these diseases, and that's what's so frightening. People are so cavalier about it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take the last three questions from the people who are standing.
Since all of you are from the United States, I believe a few years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I can't remember exactly, that National Institute of Health in Bethesda, they finally, at the government of the United States, from the pressure of alternative medicine people, so they established the so-called Institute for Alternative Medicines. But so many years already passed, I have not heard of any reports came out from the research. Anybody of you know anything about National Institute for Alternative Medicines of the National Institute of Health? Oh, none of you heard of this institute?
It's the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, and it was politically motivated, not scientifically motivated.
Yes, I heard about that. Yeah.
And they've spent a lot of our taxpayer money, and they've come up with absolutely nothing. They haven't found anything that definitely works. Whenever they find something that doesn't work, they say we need to do more studies and spend more of our money. And those of us on science-based medicine have written quite a lot about it. We think that the whole thing should be shut down. The danger of it is that now people say, oh, well, such and such must be a reasonable treatment because the government is funding studies on it.
I have a question about the recent H1N1 vaccine. During the vaccination or the call for vaccinations, there were a number of videos circulating on the Internet, on YouTube, Facebook, and the story was always the same. It was, look at this person, she just got the flu vaccine, or he just got the flu vaccine, and now she suffers this severe mental debilitation or some sort of severe symptom or side effect. And I'm wondering if this is an elaborate hoax, or if there is actually a risk, or this did occur, and what was causing it.
Right. You're probably referring to, at least the one that went viral in the United States, was Desiree Jennings, who was the Washington Redskins cheerleader that received the vaccine and had this kind of bizarre, what she called dystonia, but was really a psychological manifestation. She couldn't walk forward, but she, without this sort of halting, kind of robotic, frightening looking movement,
she could walk backwards,
she could run forward. I mean, she could run 8 kilometer races, but she just couldn't walk forward. And it was found to be, I wouldn't say an elaborate hoax, it was sort of a non-elaborate hoax. She just needed help, it wasn't the flu vaccine that caused that. But, you know, I gave a talk once at a high school in suburban Philadelphia, and about half of these were sort of honors biology students, and I asked how many had gotten the flu vaccine. This was around, you know, the time of the novel H1N1 vaccination program. And about half hadn't gotten it, and I asked why, and they all had the same reason. Desiree Jennings, you know, the Washington Redskins cheerleader who was on YouTube. So you're right. As much as we try and educate at the level of the CDC or the American Academy of Pediatrics, the YouTube video that they saw was what most impressed them. It's painful.
Actually, on that note, maybe a YouTube video of children with measles and whooping cough and whatnot would help. But anyway, my question is actually about the chickenpox vaccine. I've given it to my children, but is it correct that they're not sure exactly at what age the kids might need a booster? Because I'm concerned that they're going to need a booster when they're 20, at the exact age when they're least likely to see a doctor and get a booster, and then potentially contract chickenpox in adulthood, when I think the risks of complications can be higher, at least for boys.
So now you have a two-dose vaccine schedule, one given sort of around, you know, 12 to 15, at least in the U.S., one 12 to 15 months of age, and then a second booster dose then between 4 and 6 years of age. The reason that we did that is that we had about 4 million cases a year of chickenpox. But when we gave the first vaccine, and the first vaccine was about 90% effective at preventing moderate to severe disease, but only about 80% protecting against mild disease. So we had about tenfold reduction. We went from 4 million cases to 400,000 cases. But there were still, even with mild disease, those children were still contagious. So we went to the booster dose. With the booster dose, we got up to about 93-94% effective against mild disease. So now we were really in a position to start to eliminate transmission. So now we've gone from 400,000 cases to really fewer than 10,000 cases a year. I think we're on the road to eliminating chickenpox. When you have two doses of a live attenuated antiviral vaccine, I think it's extremely unlikely you're going to need a booster later in life. That certainly hasn't been the case with measles-containing vaccine,
or
mumps vaccine. So I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much. And there were really two themes. I mentioned numbers, of course, which is critical to science. But there was another theme that all of our speakers expressed here tonight, and that was the relationship between cause and effect and the possibility of linking these two in an inappropriate way, of having a child who develops autism and kid was just vaccinated a couple of days ago, the mother comes to the conclusion that it was the vaccine and probably will never be convinced that it was not the case. Whereas, of course, the world of science doesn't look at individual cases like that. You look at statistics, you look at large numbers, and you come to conclusions, which, of course, are always open to some error. Science is, of course, not perfect. But we must endeavor to come to the right conclusion based on observations. So I leave you with one last little story here of a gentleman who went to a physician with a rather unusual complaint. He complained that he was dead. And the doctor, a properly trained McGill physician, immediately recognized that the gentleman was wrong. He was, in fact, very much alive, but no matter what, he could not convince them. And then he decided to do a little experiment. So he took out an acupuncture needle, and he asked for his finger, and he poked his finger. Now, just before doing this, he says to the guy, he says, "Sir, tell me, do dead men bleed?" And the gentleman says, "Of course not. Dead men don't bleed. They don't have circulation. They don't bleed." So he then continued with his needle, poked the finger, and sure enough, blood spurted out. The doctor, of course, had this look of triumph in his eye. The subject had a look of confusion in his eye. I looked at the doctor, says, "Gee, doc, I guess I was wrong." The doctor, of course, gets ready for the admission. He says, "Yes, I was wrong. Dead men do bleed." Made the right observation, but came to the wrong conclusion. So thanks very much, and remember, tomorrow night, Dr. Edzard Ernst, chiropractic is on the agenda, and the Leacock Building Fieldhouse Auditorium, we start at 6 o'clock tomorrow. Hope to see you there.